Welcome to the How to Be an Author in Australia podcast. This is a podcast for writers who want to become published authors. We promise to go behind the scenes in the book industry, talking to people who love books just as much as we do. I'm Georgia Richter, and this is my co-host, Claire Miller.
Hey, Georgia.
And later, we'll be joined by the comma chameleon, who will hit us with a quiz from the editing world.
So here we are again. How are you, Georgia?
I'm really well, Claire. How are you?
Yeah, really good. We haven't caught up this week, so what have you been working on?
Well, the reason we haven't caught up is what I've been working on is judging the Fogarty Literary Award, which means head down and just read till you get to the end.
Have you found the winning manuscript?
Ooh, I'll tell you that in a little while. It's getting close, but the process has really made me think about what makes a successful manuscript. And I think the ones that are rising to the top all share the same sorts of things in common. Do you want to know what those are?
Absolutely.
All right, so this is what I reckon. I've distilled it down to four things. I think the writer has to have something to say, and they need to have found the right vehicle to say it. So the right genre, the right tone, right mode of delivery, whatever. And there needs to be confidence in their delivery. So lots of practice has actually gone in before the moment of them writing the manuscript. So they've got the techniques and they're now delivering them so that point of view is right, that that's not shifting and the metaphors are right and the writing is fresh. And there are all sorts of things that are engaging my attention. And the fourth thing, and this is really important, is they need to have thought about their audience. So there's something about these manuscripts that aren't self-absorbed, but are actually outward looking. And they are reaching out to a reader and they're working to entertain or deliver a message or something, but there is a real connection that is somehow established in that process.
Well, thinking about an audience is really important. And so I'm quite interested in hearing from you what it's been like going from being the writer of How to Be an Author to the person that's got to go out there and face the audience, be interviewed, and promote and pitch the book.
What's followed has been a kind of a learning curve for me, and I've really begun to appreciate the importance of preparation. So that if someone says, oh, what are you reading at the moment? It's not enough for me to say I'm reading 40 manuscripts that you'll see in about 18 months' time, but I actually have to think, what are the books on my bedside table? What are their titles and their author names? And just maybe even write a list so I'm ready for that question. And there are other facts like that that I need to bring with me and prepare. And the other thing that I've been thinking about, which I gleaned obviously from your input into the book anyway, is to think about who I'm going to be talking to. If it's a podcast, say I'll listen to it so I get the vibe of who they are and what they're about, what sorts of questions they ask. Also, who is the audience who is going to be listening and who will hear what I have to say? And that sort of preparation is really important in what I bring to it. And then afterwards, I have been listening back again, say if it's a podcast, and critiquing what I've done so that I can learn from what I see then as the shortcomings. How does that stack up, Claire, for you as a PR person?
So many authors don't ask me who the audience is that they might be talking to. So if I'm booking someone in, what I try to do is add a link to the show or a link to the newspaper or whatever. If it's not obvious, then I might say you'll be talking to this audience. And if you're an author, if your PR doesn't do that or you forget, because I often forget to do things or I'm in a hurry, just ask or do a little bit of research in advance, because that can make all the difference. There's no point in you talking to, say, a local newspaper in highfalutin literary language that won't reach the mums and dads and grandpas and grandmas that are reading that. There's no point talking to a literary journal from a really colloquial point of view or a point of view that doesn't show that you've really thought through the themes and ideas behind your book. You talked about your books on the bedside table. It's not just enough to have some examples of books on the bedside table. It's about knowing, well, which of those books might actually help create empathy with the audience that I'm talking to. Is that going to be Jacques Derrida, or is it going to be Sacha Wosley's Spring Clean for a Peach Queen?
Those books are both on your bedside table right now?
Yes, actually. And I don't know how to say, I don't know how to speak French, so I probably completely mauled his name. But Do you know what I mean? It's picking between those and knowing which one will actually reach the audience or create touch points for the audience.
But at the same time, you're still being authentic, right? Because you actually still are naming what's on your bedside table. You're just being selective in what information you deliver.
Absolutely, because you can't deliver your whole self to every interview. You have to pick and choose. And if you have to pick and choose, you might as well pick the bits that people will relate to.
The other thing I think I really appreciate is, say, if I'm answering to written questions for an interview, when you say to me, the tone needs to be quite casual and chatty here, or you give me some tips about that, or you will tell me what specific information points I need to hit. And that's really helpful as well.
I don't recall doing any of that, so I'm glad I have.
Yeah, but it wasn't me.
This is one of those terrible things. I'm always forgetting what I haven't done. As soon as it's done, it's out of my brain. I think there's a difference between doing a Q&A where people can see the question, and I think there's a difference between answering an e-interview that's going to go on to be a feature story where you won't see the question, so you won't see the context. So you have to be quite careful about how you answer in each of those different situations as well.
And I think another thing that's interesting is the tone. If there is an interviewer, the tone that they're bringing to it, it's important to listen to that, because I've done, say, three podcasts quite recently in quick succession, podcast interviews, and the tone each time has really been set by the interviewer, and my energy levels have been quite different depending on who it is too. So I've felt I need to actually tune into what they're after in order to respond. So, Claire, now seems like a really good time to begin our chat with Rowena Morecambe, who, as you know, is founder, publisher and editor of Good Reading magazine. She's also the publisher and editor of Spine Out, a digital YA magazine, and PK Mag for primary kids. And both of those promote books and creative works from young writers.
Yeah, you're in for a treat, everyone. But first, let's hear from author and former journalist and broadcaster Anne-Louise Willoughby, who has a tip for us.
Hi, my name's Anne-Louise Willoughby. I'm one of the authors who contributed to the book How to Be an Author, The Business of Being a Writer in Australia. Fremantle Press published my book, Nora Hyson, A Portrait, in 2019. It's an authorised biography of a renowned Australian painter, the first woman to win the Archibald Prize for Portraiture and Australia's first female official war artist. Now today I'm providing you with my best tip for aspiring writers. Research is everything. That makes sense to biography and to non-fiction more broadly, but actually, whatever genre you're working in, reading widely, questioning norms and staying curious will always lead you to insights, golden nuggets and new potential pathways for your own narrative. And I'm going to sneak in one more tip. Trust your own voice and your own ideas, because the more you read, the more you will be awed by other talented writers. Please don't be intimidated. Use it as inspiring fuel to have your work sit alongside theirs. Remember, happy reading leads to productive writing.
So, Rowena, hello and welcome.
Thank you.
We're all getting really posh now that we're actually on the podcast, aren't we? We're sounding posh immediately.
And luckily you can't see me, so I'm not as posh.
And Baxter's not with you today. You said you've locked your dog Baxter away.
Yes, he's at home. I've got an upstairs veranda and he's finding ways of getting out there. So I've got this little barricade of things because I like to leave my French doors open, and he finds a way of getting through them and out them and then barking at everybody outside. So I'm sure he's doing that. He's a real, I don't know, everybody seems to know him, and if I'm not with him, then nobody knows who I am. So
recognised by dog alone.
That's right. No one actually knows my name anymore. They just know the dog's name.
So, Rowena, thanks for coming. I know you really hate being in the spotlight yourself, even though you do a lot for authors and putting them into the spotlight. Tell us about what you do at Good Reading magazine.
So I'm the publisher and editor, so I kind of have two different arms to what I do. So I organise the books to go out to reviews each month, find out what's coming out, brainstorm ideas with my little team about what we can put in the magazine each month, build spreadsheets, which is pretty exciting, and make sure all that copy comes in, edit it down, give it to the designer, off it goes to press. But I also do the publishing side, so that's also running a whole production schedule for the magazine. So, you know, getting it ready, getting it into the printer, proofing it, sending it out to the mail. But, you know, I think in a small business too, you just about do everything and anything. I answer the phone and I talk to subscribers. I buy the milk. I, you know.
Wash the tea towels.
I do just about everything. Yeah, that's right. Take the dirty tea towels home and wash them and bring them back.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, because we only have a small team of probably 3 or 4 people, so.
Obviously, it's an online experience as well. So how does that fit with your day-to-day?
Yeah, so we started publishing a digital magazine a long time ago. So we would have been doing that for the last 12 or 15 years, which we started quite early. And we hyperlink every single title in the magazine back to our website for more information. So we have a busy bee who goes along and does all that work for us. And we have a company who converts the magazine into a digital format so people can easily read it and extract all those articles out and put it on the website as well. So, yeah, so we have a huge range of different things we have to do online. You know, digital adds a lot of work to what you do, as we all know. Yeah. So it's quite exciting. I think still people like to read things in print, I have to say. I think you can't take away that tactile experience, but it's great for people who are time poor or for libraries and, you know, people who can't afford to buy the magazine. Reading it online is a lot cheaper format to read it in. So, yeah, it's good. And you can add diversity online. You can add video content, all sorts of, you know, links to extracts and make it much more interactive experience as well.
So obviously, Good Reading Magazine is for readers. In our podcast, we're also thinking about writers. Why do you think that writers should be reading Good Reading Magazine?
I think to be a good writer, I think you should read. I think you really need to understand what a good book is and what makes it all tick. And I think unless you do read, and if you just concentrate on your own thing the whole time, then you don't get that broader aspect. So I think it's really important that they read and read the magazine and read really broadly as well, you know, across a lot of different genres. So, yeah, and I know that that's hard because often writers sort of focus in on what they're doing and find it hard to get out of that. But I think it's extremely important that they see what else is being written and how good it is too.
Rowena, did you actually start the magazine?
I did. So I was a bookseller. I was a bookseller that started it. I think I started bookselling in 1980 or something, which makes me very old, with Collins Booksellers. And I sort of worked for a bookseller for 20 years and then they opened their first Broadway superstore in Sydney. And I project managed the opening of that and, you know, picked furniture colours and I stocked the store and did the whole thing. And then I saw people come in and it was like a supermarket for books. And you'd see people come in and they'd just be wandering around like lost souls, that they have this, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of books to choose from and not know which one to read. And I think some people find booksellers a bit scary and as if they know everything. So they're a bit, not you. So, you know, I just thought that people needed something to help guide them and give them confidence to find and buy a good book. So hence the magazine was born. So I quit my job and emptied out 2 little rooms in the house. And one of the girls, Kathy Mossop, who worked with me at the time there, quit her job too. She was very brave. And we just started it. We had Caroline Baum, who people might know, as our first editor. That was 19 years ago now. So it's 20 next year, which is a bit frightening.
It's an amazing story.
And it sounds like, yeah, you really leapt into being a curator in a sense of having the whole landscape of books around you and saying people need some more guidance. That seems quite far-sighted.
Yeah, I didn't think it was far-sighted at the time and I just thought it was really obvious. But people called me brave and all sorts of things and I just was enthusiastic, really. I think that's the only thing. And probably a bit naive and... But because I had all that experience as a bookseller and as a buyer for a very large bookshop, it was relatively easy for me to step from that role into helping people find good books because I already knew everything about the authors and the different books that were out and the channels that they came from. So it was just converting that into, you know, finding those little interesting stories and providing those to readers to get them enthusiastic.
The broader media landscape, I think, has changed quite a lot, hasn't it? How does your content stack up against that landscape?
I think when we sort of started, I think The Australian had a literary supplement. There were lots of different papers that had whole supplements just dedicated to books. Then that shrank down. The Sydney Morning Herald had a really good chunky book section that shrunk down. They had a literary editor in Sydney and one in Melbourne. One's gone. Now they've only got one. It just gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And so I think the magazine becomes more and more and more important for that reason. And we're very mainstream. We don't judge what people read. I think some literary papers or journals can be literary, if you like, and a little bit scary for people, whereas we don't judge what people read. If you want to read Patrick White, that's fine with us. But if you want to read, you know, a trashy romance novel, that's great too, as long as you're reading it and enjoying it. And then, you know, they've both got their positives and their rewards. So I think it's important to show that, and to show Australian authors as well. We cover mostly Australian books. Probably 70% of what's in the magazine is Australian, roughly. And we've got world-class authors. You know, if I go back to 1980 when I first started bookselling, there were very few authors around, and Australian publishers didn't give them the treatment that they give them now. You know, the publishers have become world-class, the authors are world-class, and they deserve to be out there.
And you also, when you're talking about catering to readers, you cater to younger readers as well. So can you tell us a bit more about PK and Spine Out?
Yeah, so we started this these two magazines. I have a very evangelistic mother who was a school teacher, a retired school teacher, and she's completely passionate about children and books and whatnot. So she really sort of egged me on to do kids magazines. So we started with Spine Out with teenagers, and really what we wanted to do was to really enthuse kids about books and to give them an avenue to see themselves published. So we started Spine Out, and then I think about 10 years later, I think we started that in 2008 or something. And then 10 years later, we did PK Magazine, which is for primary kids. And one of the teachers at a presentation told me that one of their kids had a poem, because we publish kids' poetry as well as their book reviews, short stories, as well as featuring books. And she said this kid had had a poem published in the magazine, and he spent a whole week walking around the school with a smile plastered on his face. And that's really what it's all about, isn't it? It's giving them confidence, making them feel like they can achieve and they can do anything. And there are kids in the magazine who are from really high profile private schools, and there are kids in the magazine who are from really low socioeconomic schools. And it evens the playing ground as well for them, I think. So it's a bit of a passion project for us. It's exciting. It's exciting to see them excited and their little faces in there, you know, their big grins and their teeth missing. And it's fabulous.
I think also when you talk to writers, most writers have a story about a moment of recognition when they were young, which really for them crystallizes some sense of themselves as a writer. So you don't know which of those kids are going to be that appear, but that's what you're doing. Right. Providing that.
That's right. I think that's, and it's just that, and it's just a self-belief. I think when I was a kid, I had really low self-esteem. If someone had come to me and said, that painting you did was just amazing, you know, you could be an artist, I probably would have toddled off and really believed in myself and done it. And I think it's really important to keep giving them that sort of reward, that confidence all the time, right through their primary schools and into high school as well.
You're also running the Good Reading podcast. What do you think of the value of podcasts for aspiring writers?
I think there's a couple of things with a podcast. One is that they make a connection with the reader directly. So they're talking to the reader. The reader hears them and gets their story, and they have this better connection with the book. But I think it also helps lapsed readers or occasional readers who are probably time poor and don't have the time to even think about reading a book, but they might listen to it and that might prompt them to go and buy or borrow the book and read it. And I think that's a really big asset for the industry and for authors to, you know, to try and encourage those people back, because often people who are really passionate readers who read, you know, 10 books a month or something will do that anyway. But those people who not read a book in 5 years might rediscover that again through that avenue. So I think it's a really important and a great thing to do.
And it sounds, Rona, from what you're saying, that obviously you cover a lot of content, but nonetheless, there must be some competition there for people who want to appear in Good Reading magazine. So do you have room for every book that comes out in a year? How do you manage that?
No, and I wish we did. But that's the beauty of online as well. So whatever we can't physically squeeze into that magazine, then we do tend to try and cover it online as much as we can, and particularly with Australian authors. So try and give as much coverage to everybody as we can. But you can't fit everything in, and you have to say no to some things. And that's hard because authors don't want to hear that, unfortunately, or publishers don't want to hear it either. But we do try to fit in as much as we can. Mm. But, you know, we do, our market tends to be more women than men. So we do, you know, have a selection that we would normally more pick from than another. We still do nonfiction, and people, you know, our readers still like biographies and general nonfiction, but, you know, books on business, for example, you know, probably wouldn't cover those. So it does narrow the field down a bit for us.
Mm. So you're interacting directly with authors or only publishers? How is the material coming to you?
Both. So I am often annoying publishers to find out what's coming out.
Really? You never annoy me.
Yeah. Authors often contact us directly as well. So I often get an email from an author. But a lot of those are self-published. So, you know, we'll have a look at their book no matter who they are and try and help in some way. But, you know, some of them get coverage and some of them don't. But authors, I talk to a lot of authors because they do some writing for us in terms of writing articles or stories and giving them some guidance. And they're usually, that's their craft anyway. So they're usually on it before I am. So, you know, they've often written something and sent it to me before I even think about it.
Yeah. So what are your lead times? So authors understand what your lead times are.
3 months out?
Yeah.
So we're a long way out for print. Online, you know, we can do that within 3-4 weeks, but print has a very long lead time. It takes us, you know, by the time we send the book to the reviewer, the reviewer might take 2 to 3 weeks to read it and write the review. Then it's got to come back and get edited. Then it has to go to the designer. It might take us 3 weeks to design the magazine. Then it has to go to the proofing process and, you know, a week and a half to print and pack it, another 2 weeks in the mail. It goes on and on and on. So it's quite a long lead time. The earlier the better, but that's not to say that we wouldn't cover it. So we often cover books that are months late because they're important and we want to cover them. So
you're saying you're not necessarily aligning the release of your review with the release date of the book?
We try to, but if we can't, then we'll still review the book. Often publishers will have embargoes on books and not allow us to have a copy of the book until it's actually published. If it's a fairly big book, so that puts a constraint on us to cover it within time. So
if a book is being pitched to you, how do you know you've been pitched well to? What does a good pitch look like?
Oh, that's a very tricky question. Often it's a hook. So it's a story around the book. It could be, you know, the story of the book. It could be just a really interesting story itself, or the author might have a good story of how that book came about. Yeah, it's often just a gut feel. I know that sounds funny, but it's often just a gut feel that you know that if, as a reader yourself, that you'd be, you know, that'd be really interesting to hear about. So, yeah, I know that's not a perfect answer. But
but it's an answer from somebody who we know loves books, though.
Yeah.
Exactly.
True. And I suppose as publishers, you probably have the same thing. You might be, you know, they might send you the first chapter or something. So you're going to get a feel anyway, whether it's going to be good or not. Yeah, I just know.
Mm. And if you're one of the really lucky authors to nab an interview with you, whether on the podcast or in print, what are your top tips for them on preparing for an interview?
I would ask for questions if I was them. I'd ask for questions beforehand. And interviews always go all over the shop. So, you know, you might be talking to somebody and you get along really well and you start talking about the dog. Conversations go all over the place. But asking for some main questions, I think, always helps them prepare. And to relax, we're on their side, really. We're not out to get them. Just relax and enjoy the process. And we're not scary. We're just readers.
Yeah. And what makes a great interview? What are you looking for?
I suppose you're just looking for those great stories that pop out of writers, you know, that that you can draw out of them, for them just to relax and just think about their story and their book. And often it just comes out and then you've got this, you know, great quotes that you can use in the magazine for interviews. So, and I think if people are relaxed and enjoying it, then they always come out.
Can you think of a really surprising interview that you've had or one that went in a direction you didn't expect?
Oh, I can remember interviewing Bob Carr, who was New South Wales Premier, about it was a book that he'd written about his favourite books. And I can remember during the interview, it struck me that there was not one Australian author in the whole book of his favourite books, and there was not one woman. And I remember sitting there just, you know, I wasn't quite sure whether to ask him or not. I was really sweating on it because he's a politician. And so in the end, I did ask him and I got up the courage and just said, well, I don't see any women in here and not an Australian author, you know, what's going on? And And he was very good, you know. He batted it off like any politician would and just said, oh, that's book two.
Has book two ever appeared?
Yeah, no, I don't know that it has. But I've never really had a problem. I never had a bad interview. I've only ever had just, you know, authors who are really generous and with their time and very unassuming people.
So you're not going to dish any dirt?
No. Oh, no. As a bookseller, I met some interesting people. We had Jeffrey Archer in the store once, in the superstore for a signing session. And he comes in like a king kind of thing with his entourage behind him and proceeds to sit at the table to sign. And he'd insisted on a TV on his right so he could watch the All Blacks play at the same time as signing. And so he was watching the All Blacks literally and signing without even looking at the people. And then he asked for a pizza. So we had to go and get him a pizza, and he ate pizza, watched the All Blacks play, and tried to sign books at the same time. It was terrible. I hated every moment of it. I just thought, oh.
And what were his people doing while he was eating pizza and watching the All Blacks?
I think they were cringing in a corner. and then he just, you know, as he left, he just gave me his huge hug and left, and I was left kind of like a statue in the bookshop. Yeah.
With some greasy hand marks on your back from the hug. Yeah.
That's right, exactly. So that's about as much dirt that I could actually dish.
And obviously that kind of signing approach isn't going to work for a new author, I'm guessing.
No, I don't think so. It's a level of arrogance, isn't it, that... You know, but
it's beautiful.
You know, he writes good books. I mean, he writes some, you know, pacey books. So, you know,
people keep buying him.
Exactly.
Maybe they think they're buying a pizza.
Rowena, you also, Good Reading Magazine also has a connection to Booktopia. Is that right? How does that work?
So Booktopia provide a free gift of Good Reading digital edition to each person who buys books from them. So we produce a special edition for them, and each title in the magazine is hyperlinked back to their website. So if they want to buy the book from Booktopia, they can, which has worked really well for them and worked very well for us because we get a lot of exposure for the magazine as well. A lot of people who didn't know about the magazine discovered the magazine. So we've had an increase in our print subscriptions because of that, which is fabulous. So yeah, and they've also just started taking PK Mag and Spine out for people who buy children's books or people who just buy adult books as well. So they'll be getting all three magazines as a gift, which I think is a great way to, you know, double up the exposure for authors because we've got so much more depth and, you know, much more content than Booktopia could ever produce in a format, you know, that's readable and quick.
And you link through to them, don't you? So if someone likes what they see on your website, they can buy the book straight away.
Yeah. So our digital magazine links through to our website, which then links through to their website. But their edition also just links directly to them and avoids us. So we also do that for Angus and Robertson as well. Both those websites go straight through. So it's a great thing for authors, I think. Mm.
I just, from my own personal reading pleasure, would love to know what your recommendations are of books and authors that are coming up that you think we should have a read of, and think carefully. If you don't have any Fremantle Press titles in there, I'm really happy to add a few for you.
I'd like to read actually one that you've got just coming out called Death Leaves the Station, which is a sort of a cosy crime kind of thing, because I just love cosy crime. I get tired of all those really heavy, gory thrillers, you know, shoot them up. And so I'm really tempted to read that. I've just read a book by Frederick Black, I think his name is, called Anxious People, which is really lighthearted and funny. It's about a robber that goes into a bank with a balaclava on and sort of points a gun at the, you know, person in the teller. And the teller sort of has a bit of a giggle and said, "This is a cashless bank." And then, you know, the robber runs out of the bank madly and then across the road into a building, into an apartment block, and then runs into an apartment where there's an open house and all these people standing there with an open house, and there's a robber with a balaclava and a gun. And it just goes from there. It's just a really fun read in the middle of viruses. So I really recommend that one. I'm really looking forward to the, and these are just out too, the Kate Grenville Leaves, and another one by called Bluebird by Malcolm Knox, who's a well-known journalist, and that has been really well reviewed in our magazine. And the reviewer who read it loved it, and I love what he reads, so I'm going to love it too, I'm sure. So, yeah, But I also want to read the, I want to go back and read the old ones too. I like reading old books. You know, I want to read, again, Unreliable Memoirs by Clive James and things like that.
Yeah, that's a beauty. Yeah. I think there's a real, you were talking about wanting to read light in, you know, in dark times. I think there's also something very comforting about reading back into books that have given you pleasure. You know, like the sort of books that you read when you're not well, you really go for the comfort, the comfort food of books.
Yeah. I often look at my bookshelf and I look at it and I think it's sort of a reflection of my life. And, you know, there are, because I was a huge fantasy reader for a while, and I've got all these fantasy books like David Eddings and Raymond Feist and Stephen, you know, Donaldson and whatnot, all up there. And then you sort of move into more sort of, you know, the Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime Time. And then I move into a biography phase and, you know, you can see the timeline of your life and you get such pleasure because you remember how you felt when you read those books. And it's a real emotional connection, isn't it?
Mm.
Books are a wonderful thing and they make great furniture.
They do. Someone who didn't want to be interviewed who tried to put her...
I hate being interviewed.
Well, I thought you did really
well. You guys are very good.
I think the people who congregate around books are sort of slightly social averse. So I think we're all like-minded people.
It's funny that, isn't it? How that there, and maybe that's, yeah, because it's a reading experience and a more sort of, you know, introverted thing to do. But
books are a buffer.
Yeah. Yeah. But you find it's like when librarians come to me at trade fairs and things, and they just say, they walk up to me and go, oh, I found my tribe. You know, and you're part of a tribe of people who all like the same thing. You just know you're going to like them because they're just like you.
I'm quite interested in the idea of books as a buffer too, because I think I've used books as a buffer in a physical sense. If you're on the street at night, you can roll the book up and hit someone with it if you need to.
That's the thing that I actually always keep in mind looking at all the books we have at Fremantle Press. I've assessed which is the heaviest and which could be used as a weapon if it came to that. The good quality art paper.
I've never considered using my book as a weapon, but
I think if it's a paperback, you have to roll it, and I would thrust upwards rather than downwards. I think you'll get more force.
I think COVID has caused some issues. I think maybe you need to
get out,
see
more.
Somebody.
Yeah,
bit of book therapy you need.
Possibly. Oh, thank you so much for your time, Rowena. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Just a reminder that the Comma Chameleon is Fremantle Press editor Armelle Davies. When I saw her earlier at the office, she rather ominously suggested we're going to deep dive into the world of emojis.
Is a deep dive even possible into the world of emojis? I mean, an eggplant's an eggplant, right?
No, Claire, an eggplant is never an eggplant. Hi, Armelle, and welcome back. Do you reckon you can spell out ratatouille in an emoji without using an eggplant?
Oh, I think absolutely you can, yes. Hard to describe it exactly over just voice, but it can be done, I have no doubt. Yes, so emojis are quite fascinating. They are the fastest growing language in the world and they can be understood across language barriers. They can communicate meaning much more economically than words, but like you've just suggested, they can be misinterpreted. I'm sure we can all think of someone who uses emoji incorrectly or just an excessive amount of them. And although it probably sounds weird to edit emoji, it's a language just like any other. So it conveys meaning. And that means that I have to check our social media copy to make sure our emoji use works with established conventions and we're not making any unintended double entendres.
I would never do an unintended double entendre, surely. All intended.
Yes, that's true.
So what's your quiz?
All right. Our question today is, what is the most commonly used emoji? Is it A, face blowing a kiss, B, face crying with tears of laughter, or C, red heart?
See, I thought you were going to say the smiley face there.
I feel like you've kind of left out the one that really is going to be the most used.
Is this a trick question? No, it is not a trick. This is according to some very, you know, dependable internet stats.
Well, Millie, you go first this time.
The idea of blowing someone a kiss. In fact, I may have been blowing kisses and not known. I can't even picture that emoji. So I think the laughing thing with the tears.
Yeah, I avoid both of those, but I'm actually going to guess the blowing a kiss.
No, you'd only use that on Tinder or something, wouldn't you?
Well, I wouldn't know, Miller.
Me either. Amal will know. When would you use a blowing kiss, Amal?
Well, you can just use it at the end of a message to, you know, a friend or family member. It's just a friendly little blow of a kiss.
Doesn't sound very COVID-friendly to me.
Well, it is because it's digital.
True.
I guess. What are you picking?
I picked that one.
Or you pick the laugh out loud or the kiss?
No, I could pick the kiss.
All right, well, Claire's got it. It is the face crying with tears of laughter. They're actually all in the top three, those three. And the face crying with tears of laughter currently has almost 3 billion uses just on Twitter.
I think that's an overused emoji, frankly.
It's a very, I have to say, I use it a lot, especially in reaction to memes that people have sent me because it's a very economical way of reacting instead of saying, ha ha, that was so funny. You can just use a crying, laughing emoji.
Do you think people overuse it though, that actually they're not at home crying with laughter?
That's, yeah, like I rarely make the effort to cry with laughter, so why would I make the effort to use that as the emoji? It seems false to me, and things online are so, you know, they need to be authentic.
I think we have all found that that is rarely the case on the internet, isn't it? I'm not a huge fan of the blowing a kiss myself. I think my probably most used one would be the rolling eyes emoji that gets a lot of use.
I've been using the heart emoji quite a bit and I'm not really sure I'm using it correctly. It's just like, yeah, that's nice. That's how I think I'm using it, but whether or not,
yeah.
I've got a lot of boyfriends out there.
A heart is a great wholesome emoji, I think.
I think my most often used one is the upside down smiling face.
Is that a frown?
No.
Yeah, that one's a tricky one.
It's sort of an ironic, quirky smile. It seems to be the wry face, which I think is quite a good response to messages. That's probably the one I use. I feel like it's used insufficiently that I can use it as my signature.
We were talking earlier about Indigemojis.
Yeah, it's an app that was created by some Arente people from Alice Springs. They're not standard emoji. They're a separate app, so you have to use them like a picture because the emoji, the central emoji, is controlled by a company called Unicode. So if you want to add an emoji, you actually can make an application, but it has to be approved by their processes to show that it has enough cultural currency, basically.
Do you think that non-First Nations people should or can use those emojis?
Yeah, well, it's always a tricky thing. In the app itself, it says that the images were created for people to use to promote their culture. But it's always important to make sure that you've done your research and that you know what it is that you're sharing.
And have you ever come across an emoji in a book that you're editing?
Well, the tricky thing is in print books that we don't really have an easy way to use emojis in there yet, just because they're not in a very printable font. But who knows, maybe it will be in the future. We do use some smiley faces sometimes, particularly in text messages. I think maybe in some of your crime books, Georgia, I've seen them.
Yeah, I think that's probably the only emoji actually that I would deploy, and they always seem to be in crime novels.
Somewhat ironically.
Yeah. I feel like there is a novel coming your way at some point that is just solely made up of emoji.
It might have been done already. Who knows?
So should authors actually use emojis on social media?
I think they should, where appropriate. Maybe if you're like me and you don't know your eggplants, stay away from things that you don't know too well. I mean, I'm joking about not knowing too much about the heart, but I have an editor that backs me up that if I was using a heart inappropriately, then the comma chameleon would come down with her red pen and slam that emoji out of whatever tweet or whatever we're doing. So
the problem with emojis as well, though, is that they're not necessarily standardized across different platforms and devices. So what you see on your device might look totally different to someone else's and could change the meaning or the tone.
I'm always getting those alien face default emojis, you know, when the person has sent something and I'm sure that's not their intention. Do you know the one I mean? Maybe it's unique to me. It's a face of an alien.
I don't think so.
I don't know. I think it's because I insist on having...
communicating with aliens, Georgia?
Right. I think it's because I insist on having out-of-date technology and things don't translate. Do you think it's generational too, that people can more fluently read emojis, or different people can more fluently read them?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, for my generation, we've sort of grown up with emojis. I mean, I remember my first emoji that I ever received was in probably 2009. And I was at a party and my friend sent me a text message that said, "The dog smells like poo emoji." And I had no idea what it was and I was confounded.
You had no idea that that little picture that you were seeing that looked like dessert with eyes, a chocolate pudding, you didn't know what that was representing.
Oh, I think I knew what it was representing. I'd just never seen an emoji before and I couldn't believe that my phone could display it. Well, it was a new world.
Those were the days. Well, thanks, Comma, for bringing us your emoji mojo. Can't wait to see what you come up with next time.
Thank you very much. Bye.
See you.
What's the score now?
It's 2-1.
In my favour?
No.
Bugger.
You're flummoxed because you're losing.
I didn't know where that sentence was going.
It was great to have you with us today on the How to Be an Author podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on your favourite app so you never miss an episode. To discuss anything raised on today's podcast, join us on the How to Be an Author in Australia Facebook group. You'll be able to discuss the ins and outs of writing with other writers and with us, along with many of the contributors to the book Georgia wrote with Deborah Hun. How to Be an Author, The Business of Being a Writer in Australia is available from fremantlepress.com.au and at all good bookstores. See you next time.